In November, the Trump administration announced wide-reaching coverage and pricing agreements with manufacturers of GLP-1 receptor agonists. The price concessions that companies made in exchange for broadened access for some patients may be substantial, but it's important to contextualize those concessions. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Rachel Sachs, a professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Sachs has co-authored a perspective article about new developments related to insurance coverage and the pricing of weight loss drugs. Professor Sachs, before these agreements were announced, how often were Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial insurance plans covering these GLP-1 receptor agonists for obesity? And what were the financial implications of those coverage decisions?
The way you phrase the question is exactly right. Because of the highly fragmented nature of our health insurance system, there were different rules and policies governing whether and under what circumstances different segments of the market were providing reimbursement for these products for obesity indications. So there is a statutory coverage exclusion or limitation for agents when used for weight loss for covering some of these prescription drugs within Medicare and Medicaid. It's permissive in Medicaid. So there were just about a dozen, a little bit more or less, depending on the year, state Medicaid programs that were covering these products. But Medicare programs were largely not doing so for these particular indications. There was some commercial market coverage, but there's also a cash pay market that had developed in somewhat of a complicated fashion because it also involved issues of compounding products. And so coverage for these products was very fragmented and very uncertain, depending on what segment of the market you fell into.
Given the broader debates about high drug prices in the United States, why did the administration pursue agreements related to these products in particular?
These products are incredibly valuable from a healthcare perspective. They appear to have lots of different uses for people with various types of conditions. And the numbers of patients who could be on them and who could benefit from any of their various uses is extremely significant. And so there's a large unmet medical need for accessing these products. And there's a real opportunity here for the administration to seek to reach agreements to try to not just lower the price on a unit cost, but to expand access, which for these companies could be highly lucrative. So one thing that they may be doing is trading off a lower cost per unit of each product they sell, but also in exchange to obtain much broader utilization or much broader access to Medicare and Medicaid programs for these products. And so ultimately, they might come out far ahead of where they were.
So then getting back to the November announcement, what changes are being made to Medicare and Medicaid coverage of these GLP-1 agents for obesity?
So the Trump administration, in reaching these deals with Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, envisions expanding coverage under Medicare Part D for these products, both semaglutide and tirzepatide. And towards the end of the year, during the week of Christmas, CMS released a request for applications for a model that appears to be the vehicle through which CMS will implement these voluntary agreements and Medicare Part D in particular. And the request confirms key aspects of our analysis and answers some of the questions we raise in our piece, but it does still leave many other questions unanswered. So for example, we did raise questions about whether the model would be voluntary or mandatory, and we do learn from the release that the model is expected to be voluntary. We did also raise questions about incentives for Part D plans to participate, noting the potential financial impacts on those plans and the ways in which the costs of covering these products in 2026 had not been included in plans bids for that year. And the request does clarify that there will be incentives and that those incentives for plans will be important, but it doesn't actually say what they are. It offers some illustrative examples like increasing the government reinsurance for these drug fills or adjusting capitated payment rates, but we don't actually know what they are. It does also note that this model will start in 2027, but there will be a separate short-term demonstration beginning in 2026 that won't impose financial risk on Part D plan sponsors. So that's the way of operationalizing it before the 2027 plan year.
And then, how do you think these agreements are going to affect patients who have commercial insurance or those who want to buy them out of pocket?
Many commercially insured patients were already buying these products out of pocket if their insurers didn't cover them for their weight loss indications. So for patients who are already paying cash, it is helpful to them, or likely helpful, that the price has dropped. They are likely still unaffordable for many patients to use chronically. And so somebody who previously couldn't afford the cash pay prices, if their employer is now offering to subsidize those lower out-of-pocket costs, they might benefit. There is some evidence, though, that some insurers who were previously covering these products may be dropping coverage and emphasizing that these products are now available from a cash pay perspective instead. So it might really depend on what's the baseline and how are insurers responding in terms of whether they're offering to subsidize those cash pay prices or not.
You say in your perspective article that it's important to contextualize the price concessions that are made as part of these agreements. What other recent developments should be considered when we're evaluating them?
Semaglutide was selected for participation in the Medicare drug price negotiation program for the 2027 cycle of the program. And we saw the Medicare negotiated price released a few weeks ago in late November, just a couple of weeks after the announcement of the deal with both Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk. Now, tirzepatide was not selected for inclusion in the negotiation program, but you might think that the administration negotiating a price for semaglutide would have had impacts on other drugs in the class. So there is a way to think about some of these broader dynamics in terms of what's likely to be the coming Medicare price for these drugs anyway. Another issue that's going on is this availability of some of these products through compounding pharmacies. So you have these two manufacturers, right, Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, and there's arguably brand-brand competition between them, but there's also competition from some of these compounded versions. And the pricing dynamics here, as a result, where there is somewhat limited insurance coverage, there's brand-brand competition, there's compounding pharmacies, the pricing dynamics are somewhat different than the pricing dynamics in other markets.
In a related perspective article, Gandhi and colleagues discussed the possibility of encouraging generic competition for these GLP-1 agents. Is that a policy that could be pursued alongside these agreements?
It absolutely is a policy that could be pursued alongside these agreements. So in the author's piece, they're focusing on a slightly older version of these medications, and they note that the newer GLP-1s, they're more effective, they're less burdensome in terms of not requiring daily injections, and they're similarly priced to the older version. They also note that prices for the generic version haven't yet decreased substantially because, as they note, there's only one manufacturer for each of the generics. So it isn't a surprise that we haven't yet seen a shift in utilization towards some of these older generation products. One maybe broader way to look at this is to think about the life cycle of semaglutide and tirzepatide as well. So semaglutide, actually, its patent is going to expire in several countries beginning in 2026. And there's actually been quite a bit of discussion about the expiration of the Canadian patent. So there will be a significant or potentially significant generic market for not just the older versions, but the newer versions starting very soon. And so one lever you could imagine the Trump administration pulling that they have not yet focused on is the role of patent law and intellectual property law in trying to encourage these manufacturers to permit earlier generic entry in the United States as well as abroad.
Finally, What effect do you expect these coverage and pricing agreements to have on healthcare spending globally in the United States?
So these products are such an interesting test of so many of the types of issues that we consider when we think about drug pricing, law, and policy. These products are generally thought to be cost-effective or even highly cost-effective, which is not true of all drugs. But the problem here is budget impact, given the large number of potentially eligible patients. And so there's a potential concern around if you do meaningfully expand coverage of these products, which again might be warranted from a healthcare value perspective, we really ask some of these concerns around spending. And so these drugs in particular prompt us to think critically and also creatively about what policymakers can do in this situation. And so right now, what you see many payers doing is trying to lower overall spending by restricting access to these products. But you could imagine, especially as prices are coming down, that there's lots of interest in things like innovative payment arrangements. We talk about these a lot in things like gene therapy. If you have a one-time treatment and hopefully a long-term benefit, this is different. It's this chronic therapy you might expect people to take regularly. But are there other novel contracting models, thinking about something like the Netflix model, that people can use to create budgetary certainty for payers? And there's all kinds of opportunities that these products help create in our law and policy ecosystem.
Thank you, Professor Sachs.